everyone, and welcome. This is episode 327 of Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers Podcast, part of the MKE Tailgate Network. I'm James, joined by Paul and Ryan, doing this after a solid week for the Brewers. They're still starting out pretty strong here. Happy to talk about that. But first, as always, gang, how have your weekends been going since the last time we talked?
Mine was great. I was actually in Milwaukee this weekend. I went to the Midwest Gaming Classic, which was fun. Took my kids. Bought a bunch of old video games I didn't need, and then after that I took him to the game on Saturday, which was not the one to go to, but still fun. Saw Jackson's second home run, and we still had a good time. So it was a fun time had by all.
Yeah, so you did get to go to that game, so the kids will forever be talking about the fact that they saw Jackson Chourio's second home run. Which yes. is, yeah. Steve, I think, has a similar story. No, maybe they were at Greg Vaughn's first. That might have been the one that they were at. So we were discussing
that possibility. We all got Giannis jerseys. So
that's right. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. The people were very excited about that. They had a huge crowd on Saturday night for it. It looked like much more sparse on Sunday afternoon, though. I was driving the entire time. I did not see a pitch. We got in the car and drove back, and by the time we got back, we actually had to reroute. We went around and took 894 instead of 94 so we wouldn't go by the park as we were coming back into town this afternoon.
Smart.
Yeah.
Nice. Good weekend to catch a game, although, yeah, Paul, Saturday was not the right one, but at least it was fun and wild. So,
it was
yeah.
a pretty good game, all things considered, and like, you know, I talk to my kids the whole time. I was like, DL Hall, not the best pitcher to be seeing. And then we had the tour of not the best pitchers to be seeing, because we had Bryce Wilson in that game. We had Hobie for a righty who just it was Urias, right? I think Luis Urias.
Yeah.
you know, all things considered, they only gave up five, I think. It's not bad given the pitchers that were out there. Could have been a lot worse. Besides Chourio, Rhys Hoskins fly out. He was like the closest you can possibly be to hitting a home run, but not hitting a home run on that. You could tell just by watching him, like he knew he had one to crush and he just got himself out in front a little tiny bit on it. And he slowed his bat down to try and keep it fair. And that just robbed him of just enough power where it was a sack fly instead of a dinger. And it was a great piece of hitting that just didn't quite work out. So that was also fun to see.
Yeah, it's part of baseball is just you're not always going to get it exactly right. There's going to be that moment where it's just a touch off. And just a touch off is often the difference between great and blah. So baseball is funny that way.
Indeed. Lots of funny stuff to talk about this week. But first, a reminder before we get to questions, you can become a patron at patreon.com/MKETailgate. $2 a month guarantees you get your questions answered both on this podcast and on reporting as eligible. $5 gets you the question priority plus the additional exclusive content, including the Minor League Extra with Ryan and new co-host Spencer Michaelis, as well as the reporting as eligible mini pod. And Paul, I saw you dropped an episode in the last week. What did you cover?
We talked about SB Nation's insane decision to end all podcasting. Yeah. And we also talked about some issues that with Raz that people have been raising, and the quarterbacks that will be in this class, and the Vikings and Bears as the potential targets for several of them.
And we should probably just reiterate to people on this podcast, if you follow REE and we're getting it through the SB Nation feed, you need to change over to Paul's actual feed, the REE feed. So make sure you
do subscribe to the one where Matt is on the logo. That's the one you want. If Matt's not on the logo, you won't get the podcast the next time we do it, which will be pretty soon because the draft is in a couple of weeks.
That's always been the one that I follow, so I know I'm good. But yes, good reminder to go and check that and hit that subscribe button on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Do that for this one as well, if you haven't already, wherever else you listen to us. And you can give us a 5-star review for this show and on reporting as eligible, if you so please. They'll definitely need or appreciate the extra support, given that, you know, SB Nation just decided to stop, you know, supporting cheaply made great content.
Yeah, insane. Completely unhinged behavior over there. That is correct.
Yep, that's what failing media companies do, make wrong, misguided decisions all the time. Anyway, follow us here. we're still independent. We're doing great. Yep. So just make sure you never miss an episode. All right. As we mentioned, Brewers starting off really well. They're 6-2 after their first homestand of the season that followed up their opening weekend sweep in New York. They split two games with the Twins before taking 2 of 3 from the Mariners this weekend in a pretty wild series, as we talked about. While it's been a solid start to the year, I think it's probably fair to say there are some early questions about the pitching. Namely, the Brewers have only had 3 starters go beyond 5 innings in the season's first 8 games. And we saw, you know, a couple of bullpen blowups in the last week, including Abner Uribe's first blown save, Hobie Milner looking very hittable, as Paul mentioned, and Trevor Megill, well, you know, that whole thing where he got food poisoning in New York, was apparently lightheaded, but went out shopping and passed out in the middle of a store, apparently, and hit his head.
Wasn't he returning a cable box or something, or picking up a cable box?
I have no idea. It's still wild, but hey, at least he knew enough to know, like, hey, I think I hit my head. I should probably call the team doctor, and now he's on the concussion IL. So, yep. Paul, we were kind of talking. Where do you think that ranks in terms of infamous Brewers injuries?
It's pretty good because of just its two-tiered nature, I think. And like the food poisoning, some people get food poisoning. In fact, I think doesn't somebody else have food poisoning? I was listening to the post game show today while I was driving around, and they mentioned someone else's was cut short because of stomach issues. So
there's something about that, but I can't put my finger on it. The one I always think of is the Steve Sparks tearing the phone book, and hopefully this doesn't end up like that, where it's actually a long-term
hopefully
serious.
Not. Yeah, you don't. Yeah, that's hard on the shoulders. You don't want to do that if you're a pitcher, even a knuckleballer. But like, I feel like we've all had food poisoning, and I thought he was either returning or picking up a cable box at the cable company. I could be wrong, but I'm going to run with it just because that's what I heard and remember. And I think we've all kind of been there, where you know it's kind of the line is long and not moving because it's a cable company. And it's kind of stagnant air. And, you know, I've felt horrible in those places many times, and having food poisoning, I think you could see how that kind of thing could happen, even though it is very random to happen to a professional athlete who happens to be one of our better pitchers. So, like, I think that's up there. It's not the phone book is macho stupidity. I think it's up there with, like, stepping on the cactus and the salad tongs, which I think is also kind of a, like, if you're doing dishes, you will eventually cut yourself on some implement that's not a knife in a stupid fashion. It'll happen. So that one makes sense. And this one, I think, kind of makes sense too. It's kind of an everyday massive injury that really anybody could have.
Yeah. Plus Megill is 6'9". So, you know, his Doggins got further to fall.
Yeah.
You know, more picks hits. Up more momentum on the way down.
F equals MA. That is, there we go. A lot of M and A going on there.
I guess back to the starting rotation, as I mentioned, you know, I guess how big of a problem is it? You know, it's early, but just about everybody's been struggling to get through 5 innings. You know, we saw Colin Ray on Sunday throw 6 complete innings. He's only the second Brewer to do that, and the first since Freddie on opening day. So, Paul, I feel like eventually this kind of has to come back to bite you, right?
Well, yes, and to all of our credit, we said this was going to happen, and it didn't take long for it to happen. They lacking the studs, they don't have guys to reliably get through 5, 6, 7, and Colin Ray doing a nice job today, and also Thiago Vera picking up the amazing 3-inning save in a huge
love pool. Those.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and they were going to get – they had Hobie starting to stretch – if he didn't get the next out. And so he did a nice job too. It was actually like kind of like an intense, like high wire act in a blowout game, because it was like, don't waste the bullpen by not getting out of this. You can do it, man. And he did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Felt really, yeah. I actually did a fist pump when he got out of it. So
as did I
hope he got the game ball. But this is a problem for the Brewers. Their starting rotation is full of question marks. It is full of guys who are not, ordinarily going through a ton of innings, even Freddie at the top. And until they get Miley back or Gosser back or lots of other guys back, their depth on who is there to start is also limited. And then throw in a couple of weird random bullpen injuries. And, you know, you get in situations like Saturday where I think Saturday was really a rest day for all the good pitchers. That's really what it did seem like. It seemed like they were throwing guys out there in reverse order of good bullpenness. Like it was.
Well, yeah, because they were behind. Like as soon as the bullpen came in, they were never ahead. So you're gonna use your relievers in that reverse order.
Yeah, but they were also never out of it. Like it's not like it was a puntable game, you know. But it was still like, okay, Bryce Wilson, go pitch for as long as you possibly can. Hobie, go face. He did get the lefties out to his credit, but go face a righty and then go face lefties and do his best. And then Buskauskas, I got to work on that. Is not terrible. They just needed a guy to finish the game. So,
no, Bukowskis is pretty good. I think
he's good. Yeah,
yeah.
They were waiting on as long as possible before they used someone of value in that game.
Yeah, I think you're right here. We highlighted this and we've talked about it, so it is a thing. But I also would caution that we don't want to draw too many conclusions about this early part of the season. As sort of came up in my mind today was somebody said, "Why are we pulling Colin Ray after only 81 pitches through six innings?" And at that point, we didn't know that he was actually sick. Did you catch that? That Colin Ray?
Oh, it was Colin Ray who was sick.
No,
okay.
No, no. Well, Colin Ray was actually sick today and was pitching below par, not feeling his best, and managed to gut out six really good innings. Now, granted, he had a big lead basically from the word go. I mean, he was pitching on a big lead for most of that game. Having six runs in the first two innings will really help you out on that. But he still did really well. And what it reminded me of is the fact that we shouldn't be surprised when a Brewers manager pulls a pitcher at 81 pitches after six innings early in the season, because Craig did this all the time too. They want to ease pitchers into the season. They're not, everybody has this idea that like pitchers can go to 100. The Brewers really in Craig's tenure here don't like pushing their pitchers in April up to that 100 mark. They like him in the 80s and 90s and are not trying to really push them into the most possible innings that they're going to have. So I think we have to reserve judgment a little bit here about some of these guys and their ability to go deeper into the games, just because early in the season, especially the circumstances we've been in with all these off days, they have had the flexibility to be able to just go shorter starts and really have a quick hook on these guys. So yes, it bears watching, but I wouldn't draw too many firm conclusions based on what we've seen so far, just because I think that there's some circumstances there that make it more likely that they would have been a little bit quick on their hook than they might be in, say, June. So kind of hold that thought and put a pin in it for later, but we'll see.
Well, I don't think it's surprising that they pull Freddie and Colin Ray early-ish compared to what we're sort of used to in our reigns. I think it's more that the rest of the staff can't really get through four. That's the big issue.
Yeah, sure. There's some of that, especially. Yeah, Joe Ross was clearly done when he had to come out. DL Hall, we're going to talk about that more in a minute, so I'll leave that. Junis is an interesting situation too, because he's on the IL now. What was the phrase they were using for
scratchy
that?
Scratchy shoulder.
Scratchy shoulder. Yeah, I don't like that shoulder at all. That sounds like
no. That
terrible.
Sounds bad.
Yeah.
Yeah,
shoulders aren't supposed to feel scratchy.
No.
I think part of it too is they've had all these off days to sort of play with. So you know, they had opportunities to kind of maybe lean on the bullpen a little bit more, but obviously that's going away very shortly. We're past that point. And now the Brewers are headed into a stretch where they're going to play quite a while without a day off, including a 7-game and 7-days road trip out to Cincinnati and Baltimore in this upcoming week. So that sort of leads us to our first Patreon question. It comes from Michael Heitkamp this week, saying Pat Murphy said they'll probably go to a 6-man rotation during this stretch with limited off days. How tenable would a 6-man rotation actually be when they probably aren't getting much length out of anyone in the rotation? Just like we mentioned, to me, it feels like it would be tough to cover these innings when locking a sixth guy into the rotation rather than the pen. So Paul, I guess, how do you see the sixth man thing playing out? I know, you know, Ashby's back now. They're hoping to get Wade Miley back, so that might help.
I think just all things being equal, you are the Brewers and you have a bunch of fairly flat starting pitching options. Like nobody's, other than Freddie, nobody's super good compared to anybody else. And you have this excellent bullpen, but you know, with limits, I think the six-man rotation makes a lot of sense, because what you're fundamentally doing is putting one of either your fringe starters or middle relievers, whoever's going to be the sixth man, depending on injuries and all that stuff, with a good matchup platoon-wise that that person can prepare for and basically take three innings out of the hands of the rest of the bullpen. You know, five-man rotation is nice if you've got guys you want to try and squeeze an extra start over a day. That's not really modern baseball, certainly this early in the season. So it would say a modest improvement. If you go to five-man, what you're going to fundamentally run into is a pitcher who doesn't go as far, probably, in that fifth start, and you got to lean on the bullpen a little bit earlier. It's sort of just choosing where you want to have an exposed weakness. And the sixth man actually, I think, puts it to the bullpen with a little bit more prep and a little bit more like they know what's coming versus the five man, where it can turn into an emergency drill more easily. So it frankly doesn't matter that much. It's like the 3-4 versus 4-3 defense in the NFL. It's just a guy standing up versus a guy putting his hand on the ground. And that's kind of the same thing here. It's just where guys pitch more than anything else and how much you get to prepare a guy and give him an advantageous matchup versus having to scramble to fill in for a fifth starter who maybe isn't going as long because he is on shorter rest.
Yeah, I mean, they have the guys to do this. Wade Miley appears to be just about ready to come back. Aaron Ashby's already up with the big league team. He was put on the roster today when they decided to put Junis on the DL. They decided to do that, they did that. What this is going to be is this is going to be the beginning of seeing guys like Jansen Junk, Bradley Blaylock, and say Vladimir Gutierrez, who I know almost nothing about at this point. In fact, I was just realizing now that he's on the 40 man now. So I'm going to need to learn about Vladimir Gutierrez. I guess that's my homework for this week, because this is when we're going to start to see those guys get rotated in. This is how you work this. They're going to have to do this. And obviously, I think we're probably, as long as everything's going okay with his recovery, McGill will probably see back in here shortly too. And that means we'll see rotating out of guys like Bukauskas will pitch, you know, multiple innings at some point and then be sent down to the minors. Remember, they have five options for everybody to be able to send down. Five up and downs, not including IL stuff. So they have some flexibility, and it's during these time periods when they're going to burn those opportunities, because they're going to need to. So they have their setup to be able to do this. They will do it. It's just sort of a question of exactly who and how that's going to get done. Not super concerned. It really more becomes a question as the season goes on of how deep are you going to go? How far down the depth chart do you have to scratch to be able to run that rotation through AAA and the big leagues?
All right. We do have some other Patreon questions regarding the pitching, so we'll just jump right in. Jay Google asking, it seems like everyone was pretty encouraged by D.L. Hall's outing, and he got to the sixth inning. Are we seeing a slow progression in the right direction? I will say at least he got some whiffs on Saturday night. He did kind of get hit around with that singles hit parade in, what was it, the third inning, that kind of really undid him a little bit there. But he, as Jay mentioned, he made it into the sixth inning. So, Paul, you were there. I don't know how much you were able to see there that night with the kids there, but how do you feel about DL? Like, obviously, he's still not generating a ton of whiffs, but maybe at least a little bit.
I feel so much worse after seeing him in person. And he generated some whiffs, but like, guys were making pretty easy contact on him, especially the better hitters on the team. And it was just every at bat was agonizing. Just leaning on his off-speed stuff, I think, to a fault. Really nibbling and not getting calls. And I don't even know what his walk numbers were in that game, but he had a three ball count on like every single guy that he faced. So It was a singles parade, but all the contact actually seemed pretty good. He got a bit unlucky. There were a couple of instances where Willie Adames and Oliver Dunn crossed each other up. I think the third actually could have gone a lot better and been a lot cleaner with just slightly cleaner defense. Willie actually did himself dirty a couple times too on balls up the middle that he actually seemed to give up on a little too early, and you could tell he was mad at himself for. So, you know, it was one of those things where it kind of built on itself in that inning, but he still didn't look good. Like, he was struggling to get outs. Everything was an adventure, and it just didn't look good. Every other pitcher in the game, Bryce Miller who pitched for the Seattle in that
game? Really good.
Yeah, he is obviously a very good pitcher, but just seeing them together, like, it was like Bryce Miller's like first pitch strike every single time, like missed bat, like one of the next two pitches every single time. And then D.L. Hall comes out and it's like, you get behind like 2-0, then you have like a bunch of foul balls and just took forever. First two starts, not encouraged by D.L. I'm not long on D.L. at this point. I think he could use a little more work.
Yeah, so I got kind of yelled at on Twitter by people when I said, yeah, I kind of echoed what you were saying, Paul. And a lot of people got really mad at me. They're like, no, he got really unlucky, like historically unlucky, like really, really badly unlucky. And so I went to StatCast and looked it up to see like just how unlucky, because I was watching, I was at a 75th birthday party. So I was, I kind of had half an eye on the TV and was watching somewhat, but not real closely. And looking at what happened in that inning, I don't know. I mean, you can make a case that the Mariners definitely got luckier than they should have. That inning very easily could have ended up with, you know, one or no runs scoring. But there was more good contact in that inning, I think, than people that are jumping to his defense maybe want
to. Yeah, to jump in really quick there, Christian Yelich caught like three rockets in that game that were hit directly at him. That if they're, you know, an angle or two one way or the other are doubles or triples. That also happened in that game.
Yeah. And like, I get it that in that third inning, that if we focus entirely on that, yes, the Mariners did get somewhat fortunate in that inning. But as you're saying, there were other instances where they were making hard contact and it wasn't, you know, falling for a hit or whatever. So, yeah, I think that I'm still nervous about where he stands, and I would be very interested to see how this would play up in the bullpen right now. But I don't think that's a luxury they can afford at the moment, and I think that's fine that they're giving this a shot and going through it. His starts, I mean, have not been disasters. This has not resulted in disaster. I think if he keeps pitching exactly this way, I think disaster is coming, but we haven't seen a total disaster yet. Yes, they lost yesterday's game, but they could have won it too. They were, you know, he didn't give up too much. So, it wasn't like say Hancock today, like that. He knocked them out of that game. This was not that. So we'll see. But I don't know. I'm still waiting on D.L. Hall. I'm definitely not anywhere near being sold on him as a starter. I'm going to need to see pretty significant improvements across the board. You know?
Yeah. I will also say I'm only going on the radar gun in the stadium, which is who knows. But his fastball velocity, I think, was a little down from what it has been in the past. And maybe that's just the difference between reliever to starter. But he was like he was throwing some 91 to 92 mile an hour fastballs in that game, at least what read up on the board is fastballs, which also stuck in my brain is not great.
Yeah, that's not great. I'm pulling up a StatCast too, and he topped out at 94 in that game. Another thing about him that we've been talking about is just like not consistently in the zone, and that bore out again too. He had 90 pitches in this game, only 44 were in the strike zone. So 44 pitches in the strike zone, 46 out of the strike zone. Batter swung at 42 of the pitches. I'm just scrolling through right now. They made contact on 35 of his 90 pitches. So again, not missing a ton of bats. They only have four of his pitches being hit hard into foul territory. And maybe those were all the ones at Yelich that you were talking about. But again, like,
well, I mean, some of them were right at this. Some of them were at Yelich. Like Yelich caught a lot of rockets at him. There was also one that was a home run that somebody hit that was fouled by, you know, 5 feet.
Yeah. Right. A better, hotter offense than what Seattle's putting out there right now, because they're pretty cold. A better, hotter offense than Seattle would have done more damage to him. So, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Next Patreon question comes from LaCroix Suitcase asking, was bringing in Bryce Wilson a bad decision on Wednesday? Should we be questioning Pat Murphy's decisions yet? I don't want to get too down on anything while the vibes are still immaculate. So I think that was kind of the first time we saw this year, right? Like an example of what Paul was talking about earlier. You can't use your best guys every day. That was definitely that Wednesday, the second game of the Twins two-game series. It was a throw the scrubs out there and hope to get through it. So that's how you get Bryce Wilson pitching in a tie game, and then he gives up a, frankly, it was like a lollipop of a home run to, I think it was Jeffers, the catcher. It seemed like it was in the air forever. But that ended up being the deciding factor there. So I guess, Ryan, too soon to be making anything on bullpen stuff?
Yeah, very, very too soon on this sort of thing. There's a lot going on here. One of the things going on was that Piamps was supposed to be the guy to shut down that inning. And the fact that he couldn't meant that Murphy had to go to like a second option within that inning and not go with like what he was planning to do for his normal sequence. And we don't know exactly, other than we can assume Uribe probably would have had the ninth. We don't know exactly where they were going to go in the eighth with that, but they were trying to get through that time period. And then they had to switch it up and go a different direction as far as what the plan was there. So yeah, reading anything into that, I don't think you can. I also think that it's a bit of an overstatement. Like, the bullpen wasn't, like, overly taxed, and Piamps hadn't pitched overly much. I guess that was his – it was his fourth time pitching in 6 days, but he hadn't even thrown, like, 50 pitches in those outings. So it wasn't like
it was his first back-to-back, I think, is what Murphy noted. But still, he's going to have to do that.
Right, exactly. That's part of the gig, and also it's early in the season, so theoretically guys are a little bit fresher. I was – curious to see, we haven't seen Piamps since then. So they on Friday went to get out of Freddie's inning. They went to Hudson and then had Piguero come in as the setup man, and then went to Uribe, and then he blew it. So we still haven't seen Piamps since last Wednesday, which I was wondering maybe if they would give him the ninth today just to get his feet back under him. But given the run of games that they have right now, where I think they play the next 10 straight days before they have an off day again, he's gonna get his chance soon enough anyway. So that's probably fine.
Another Pat Murphy question, Mount Doom 98 asking, 8 games in, how would you grade Pat Murphy's managerial performance? Anything surprising? Yes, I know it's early. I think for me, man, they're running a ton. Like, I knew that maybe Murphy might run a little bit more, but it's literally top of the league stuff. Like, every time they're on baseball, somebody's going.
Yeah, part of that is just because Terang is getting on base a ton, more than we would have expected, and he's going to go every time. I think the only time he hasn't attempted to steal a base was when he was on base on Saturday when Trio hit the home run. Like, he just didn't give him a chance to steal before he hit the home run. I think Murphy's done a good job so far. I don't really have any notes. I have not picked up on any, like, bizarre pitching choices or weird platoon or gut feeling things. I think everything's been pretty justified. Like, Bryce Wilson's got to pitch sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like, he's on the team. That's going to happen. And I think mostly those decisions have been fairly justified. I think the aggressive running is fine. The defense has been quite good. And I kind of like the way they're handling Churio, where when he has the platoon advantage, they lead him off, and when he doesn't, they bat him ninth. I think they might be moving him up sometime in the not too distant future if he keeps doing this. I think that's a good way to expose him to, like, both sides of the pitching spectrum without exposing him too much. I think that's actually a really good way to do it. You don't want to take him out against same side pitching. You want to minimize any damage it might do to your chances now. So I think there's been some clever stuff that's gone on, and I haven't really seen any obvious mistakes, certainly not above and beyond what you expect managers just to make in the course of calling a game. So, yeah, I'm pretty happy with Murphy so far. I think he's been fine.
Yeah, so I would say that the biggest thing is it just looks like Craig Counsell's managing this team still.
It does. There's no difference. You couldn't tell.
Yeah, especially the way they're deploying pitching and all of that stuff. I guess some people are definitely yelling right now that he went with reverse platoon splits against that one Twins pitcher who had,
which you can argue is better than what Council did.
And yes, you can argue that that's better, and also you could argue that that's not that big of a thing, especially over the course of like 162. That probably isn't going to come up as much as people think it is. So in that case, it was, I think it was largely because they were facing a guy who had a changeup and was really, really heavy, good on the changeup. I can't remember exactly who it was. But that is the case where when a guy, when his best pitch is a changeup, you often do go with same side, because opposite sides often really struggle against the changeup. It's the way to neutralize opposite side hitting. So, yeah, I don't think we can draw any big conclusions from that either.
It's definitely been a good start. And speaking of drawing big conclusions, we've got a couple of questions here that are kind of related, so I'll just lump them together. We've got the cheese for Wilson Contreras' wine saying, "Guys, bros, gentlemen, men, Yelich is pulling home runs, Churio is producing, Adames looks like his 2021 self, Hoskins is great when he doesn't ground into a double play, and the rotation is good enough. Please talk me down before I get my hopes too high." And then we have Ian Pomplin writing, "Pro Baseball Reference has, at the time of this writing, the Brewers projected to be a 96-win team and a 70% chance to win the division. Somebody bring me back to reality." Ryan, do you want to do the honors of deflating the high hopes right
well,
now?
Well, let's start with the second one first, because saying that's a projection isn't really how Baseball Reference rolls. This is not a projection. They're not using projected stats the way that FanGraphs and Baseball Reference Baseball Prospectus do with Pecota. They're taking and they're balancing out what has happened with mostly how they projected at the beginning of the season. Baseball Reference is simply just looking at it historically and going, teams in this position have done what from then on. So it's this isn't really a projection. This is a different thing. So Baseball Reference isn't doing the same thing that Pecota or FanGraphs, you know, Szymborski is doing. These are different animals. So that's one thing to just know there. The other part of it, yeah, I mean, things are looking pretty good. The Yelich thing has my attention. It definitely has my attention. I don't think we're going to see MVP Yelich again. I think that's extremely unlikely. But if we were going to see MVP Yelich again, I think this is the kind of start that we would have seen. So, like, I'm telling you, there's a small, small chance that we're seeing a real resurgence from Yelich right now. But obviously, we just have to wait and see how it sustains. Yeah. Most likely not, but a tiny percentage chance.
We'll see if he can, you know, keep the injury bug away a little bit too. He did struggle a little bit on Saturday, was out of the lineup on Sunday. Just a rest day. I don't think anything to be concerned about. But, you know, the day after kind of an offer, you know, that's veteran rest sometimes is because veterans need rest. But, like, I'm not going to talk you down too much. Even if you go to, like, DRC to see what, if there's anything underlying here that's not super sustainable, like, everybody's pretty much above average. Like, Yelich is a 127 and Rhys Hoskins is a 114 and Willie's a 114. And there's some small sample size guys who are also above 100 who I'm not going to name. Jackson Chourio's just a little under and Terang's just a little under because of, you know, the singles on Terang. But when you account for his stealing successfully every single time he's on, that, you know, that adds up to a very productive player. So their offense, I don't think, has really been a ton of smoke and mirrors. If there's going to be some regression here, it probably is Terang not having as many ground balls get through. And, you know, maybe Yelich just starting to get, you know, need a couple more rest days, fatigue starting to set in a little bit. And maybe this is just a blip. We've seen the blip before. It's not unprecedented. But, you know, a lot of these guys are supposed to produce. Like, Contreras is good. Yelich is good. Hoskins is good. Adames is good. And so far, that's how they've played. So I think there is every reason to be high on everybody. I think the only really downside of the Brewers' start to this season is that everybody else in the Central Division has a winning record, too.
Yeah. Everybody's off to a great start in the Central. That's very annoying.
It is.
Yeah. Well, let's wait until we start beating up on each other. It's going to be... I think this division is sneakily a lot better than what people thought, and that's easy to say that, given where we're at here. But once they start beating up on each other, because I don't think anybody has really played divisional games yet. I don't, Off the top of my head, I don't think anybody's played each
other.
If
there have been, there have not been many.
Yeah, and we're about to start seeing that, obviously, with the Brewers going into Cincinnati this week. We're starting to see some NL Central teams.
Yeah, I will say, you know, we were talking about the Baseball Reference standings and Fangraphs. I pulled up Fangraphs, and they now have the Brewers at above 500, 81.9 and 80.1. So they had them at, what, 78, 79 to start the year? So at least things
are
creeping up.
Yeah, they were closer to 80. It was Pecota that was a little more down on them.
Yeah. Still, though, Cubs upping projection to 84.3, Cardinals at 82.9, and the Pirates at 81.1. Like we said, it's all within, literally, it's the Cubs and then the Cardinals, Brewers, Pirates, and Reds all at 80 or 81 or 82. So, yeah, it'll come back to earth soon here. Continuing the discussion, I should say, on Christian Yelich, Jake Prohaska has our next question on Patreon. Jake's asking, how many batting cage sessions did it take you to fix Yelich's approach at the plate? I assume he's talking to you, Paul. That's two pulled and one deep to center already. But seriously, is there not a noticeable difference for him at the plate, or is it too early to tell?
I want to go first. I think he looks legitimately better. I think he is getting through the zone much more quickly. He is getting around on inside pitches much more quickly. Mm-hmm. It looks like MVP Yelich on those home runs that he's hit so far. That's, I think, the reason we're all kind of like, yeah, maybe. Because it's not like he has never pulled balls over the last few years. He usually has like two or three that he does pull for home runs. But usually they are, I think, mistakes. They're... he was around too fast on a changeup, and that's how that happened. That is not the case here. Like, he is pulling some good pitches and not just home runs. He's pulling a lot of balls with power. I think it's just finally him recovering, but maybe they actually did do some work to get him to pull more. Maybe some new people in the organization are bringing a new batting philosophy to ground, and that may help Yelich adjust his approach. It's not unusual for veterans as they age to start concentrating on pulling the ball more as their bat speed slows down, and it also may just reflect that. But either way, I think it's different. It looks like a different Yelich than we've had recently, and that pull power is something that is both intentional and real.
Yep. We already pretty much talked about this. Let me talk about Churio a little bit. That's been also quite good. You can see he's going to go through ups and downs. There's going to be, it was mentioned on the radio broadcast today that he had a really very poor plate appearance. And then he came right back with a really nice one right after it. And they said, you know, this is something that you're just going to see from him. And I think we need to keep that in mind, that there's going to be ups and downs with Churio. But that he got on the board right away with these two home runs through the first, eight games of the season, that does give you some good feelings and some good confidence here that he is a dangerous hitter and is already causing troubles to big league pitching. Now, when they start adjusting to him, what is he going to do to adjust back? We have to see all that stuff play out. But obviously, you would much rather him start out this way than, somebody else, Pete Crow Armstrong, for instance, that you want him to turn out to get going out of the box like this, as opposed to what PCA did for the Cubs last year, which was absolutely nothing offensively for quite a while.
Yeah. Oh, really quick, just two other Churio things, since this is my first time actually seeing him in person. He is much bigger than I think you expect. TV, he looks more like a kid on TV. In person, he looks like a very large person. I actually can't believe how fast he is for his size. And the second thing is, his eye is amazing. I have already seen like five instances this season where umpires have made a clearly incorrect call, calling a strike that was a ball. And he, first of all, he's very mature. He doesn't like turn around and jar. But you can tell. He's like, no, that was bad. He steps out. He looks back. He's like, the last time he did it, it was on a low outside pitch, and I think it was during the week. It was one of the weekday during the day games. It was low outside pitch, and it was a call to strike, and it was definitely a ball. He looked back at the umpire, didn't say anything. The next pitch was the same place, trying to get the same strike, and he poked it to right field for a run scoring single. So Lots of good stuff on Churio. Lots of advanced stuff. Smart, very smart kid, and super strong too. Like, yeah, everything's been good so far on him. Just inexperienced little things.
Yeah, I didn't see that, and that is fantastic. That story is that's exactly what you want to hear from a guy like that, where it's like, okay, well, fine, I'll adjust. And he was smart enough to think, you know what, if that guy just got that call and saw me reacting to it, he's maybe going to try to throw that same thing again. So let's load up for it and be ready and then do what needs to be done with it. Yeah, that's perfect. That's exactly what you want to hear about a young kid like this.
Yeah, I think overall it was an incredibly encouraging week for Churio, especially because, you know, we were talking last week about the opening series in New York, and I was saying, you know, I saw just about everything I wanted to see from him, and you guys were saying, yeah, but the power, and well, that came this week too. So, I think just overall, yeah, it's really an incredible week or so that he's been on, and we'll have to see how they adjust. But, you know, that example Paul pointed out showed that, you know, even in game, he's capable of making those adjustments. So hopefully, fingers crossed, the, you know, rookie learning curve isn't quite as steep because of that. So, also, one more thing before we move on. I would like to dust off the Christian Yelich launch angle tracker. He's
at,
11.8 degrees to start the year. So, ooh, you know, when you hit a Titanic,
is, sexy.
When you hit a Titanic 430-foot shot with like very much launch angle, that'll probably sway the numbers. But I think also on the encouraging column there, it's that pitch was a slider that just stuck in the middle of the zone, didn't do anything, and he just demolished it. And, you know, to your guys's points, the last year or two he might have just slapped that the other way, right, instead of just unloading on it. So I think that is super encouraging to me as well.
Yeah, when he hit that ball, I was at that game, and everybody around me just like jumped up, and I just like laughingly said, well, that counted, and I immediately went for the phone. Yeah, I think I may have started typing it before the ball actually landed.
If anybody wants to see the Churio at bat, by the way, it was off of Louis Varland on the second against the Twins in the bottom of the second inning. And it was on an 0-1 count, and that is exactly what happened there. So,
awesome stuff. Similar note, Mattingly's sideburns asking, after seven games, well, eight now, what makes you more optimistic for the season? Yelich hitting three home runs, two of which counted, or Churio hitting two home runs. So we're all very optimistic and encouraged by both of these things. I guess, Ryan, which one is the most reason for optimism?
Yes, just they both are. And yes, I will say about the Yelich thing, two of them counted, but that one that doesn't count, that was hit on a line to dead center and was an absolutely fantastic piece of hitting. This was not something where he stuck the bat head out and just popped it over the fence out in left field. That was a well-struck ball to pretty much dead away center. So that one, if it doesn't count, it's like 2.5. Like,
I agree.
It's 2.5.
It was like 430, so it was an absolute tank job. That we should, I think, count that one.
Yes.
I will go with Yelich, I think, is the more optimistic thing, only because it's good to get the hot start from Churio, for sure. And, you know, good to see. But if this team's going to be like a super contender, someone that can make noise both in the season and in the playoffs, getting Yelich to like be like 90% of MVP Yelich or 80% of MVP Yelich is huge to have that happen. Churio, we're on the development course, and this is nice. It's gravy. And if he can be also good right away, that's great. But, you know, if you can sneak out a good Yelich season, it does a lot for their chances.
Yep, absolutely.
Absolutely. All right. Since we're talking about Yelich, I'll pop down to My Only Lemonade's question, who is writing, Russell A. Carlton from Baseball Prospectus just published an article questioning the effectiveness of using the DH as a way to rest position players. That's interesting. Basically, data show that player hitting performance declines on those quote unquote half days of rest, and that teams might be better off with a dedicated DH on the roster. If we accept this as correct, would the Brewers be wise to slot Yelich in as the everyday DH in the near future? Seems like it might be the way to solve the current logjam in the outfield. Ryan, you're shaking your head no. Why?
Because, first off, there isn't a current logjam in the outfield because of the injuries. So the fact that Garrett Mitchell is hurt, the fact that Joey Weimer isn't yet up in the big leagues. Like he's still slugging it out in AAA, trying to regain his swing and figure out what's going to work there. And honestly, if you're going to do this, Yelich is still a competent left fielder, even a pretty decent left fielder, I think, at this point, compared to left fielders who are, you know, mostly trash. So he's pretty solid in that aspect. Ideally, actually, I think if you're going to do this with somebody, it would be Hoskins. Because he is legitimately bad at first base, and Jake Bowers is actually surprisingly good. Now, whether he's going to start hitting, I don't know. But that's kind of a separate question. Like, if you're going to do this, I sort of lean away from it being Yelich being the one that you really need to do it, at least at this point in the season. I think this is one of those things you keep your options open for a while. You're going to keep doing this for a while. But I said in the preview episode that the ideal thing for this team was going to be that as we got to towards the end of the season, if Hoskins could become the everyday DH, because we know he's a bad defender at first, that would kind of be the best. If everything settled out so that we could get him at DH and we had somebody else who was actually a good first baseman to be able to fit in there, that would be the like platonic ideal for where this team could go. But for right now, keeping our options open seems like the best way to go.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I'm going to go read that. Russell does good work, of course. But I feel like there's potentially a lot of confounding variables with that as well. Russell's a very smart person who thinks about confounding variables, and I'm criticizing him sight unseen is not something I'm going to do. I'm sure it's a good piece, but want to give it a look before we decide that the permanent DH is the way to go, because there is also value towards keeping bats in the lineup while not exposing players to, you know, the harshness that some position players have to deal with, especially catchers, who are a lot of who our DHs tend to be. I want to check out how catchers are treated in that study, because if anybody benefits from a rest day while hitting, catcher's going to be the position versus, you know, taking a random Yelich. Like, left field isn't that taxing on you. Shortstop's taxing on you. Catching is taxing on you. Left field is where they put guys who aren't good at fielding in the first place. So, you know, it's jogging mostly and not throwing that hard. It's fine. But, you know, worth considering. But Hoskins is the correct answer anyway. Ryan's right.
Yeah, and there's another thing too here. Like, you wonder about that because yesterday was William Contreras' first game where he wasn't catching. You had Gary Sanchez in there catching for him. And Contreras didn't have, I don't think he had a good game offensively yesterday. I'm not.
On exactly. Saturday he did. He went 2 for 3. He had at least 2 hits. Yeah. There was a no-hitter going for a while. He broke it up, and then he had the second hit. For a while, he was the only Brewer who had hits in that game.
Okay. Well, and then obviously on Sunday, he went
and obviously
to town.
Today.
Yeah, I mean, he two should have been 3 home runs. And by the way, his ass is going to get fined in Kangaroo Court. If they still do that, do they still do Kangaroo Court in the big leagues? That seems like maybe that's an old tradition that maybe has gone away. But I think if Kangaroo Court still exists, his ball that he didn't run out in today's game, that is a classic case where you take a fine in Kangaroo Court for that thing, because he definitely did not bust it out of the box. He thought that ball was gone.
Yeah.
All right. Speaking of catching, I'll jump down to Devin Barrowell's question asking about William Contreras, saying, I know it's early, but I read somewhere that Contreras's framing numbers are really bad so far. I think they had him as the second worst framer in all of baseball. Is this just a small sample size thing or him regressing a bit back to his old norm? So I kind of looked this up coming into today. I know Baseball Prospectus had Contreras ranked 56th out of 60 qualified catchers.
Yep.
And called strikes above average. I mean, that might be a little harsh because there's a bunch of people, him included, at negative 0.001. So Obviously not a huge sample here. There's a big glut of stuff to sort out, but Fangraphs also has him tied for last among qualified catchers. They have 20. He's tied with Will Smith. So Paul, I know last week we were talking about him kind of being stabby, as you said. It definitely became more noticeable to me this week after you mentioned that. What have you seen?
Yep, I agree with that, and I still think it's a problem. And while that is a small sample size, and you know, 0.01 of anything is just noise, I think he doesn't look as smooth on his framing this year. I just don't. He Same as last week. I actually think his vertical game still looks okay, and that he is still bringing stuff into the zone from the bottom of the zone fine. But horizontally, he's all over the place, and I think it has been a legitimate problem so far and something that they could stand to work on a little bit. Sometimes framing doesn't age well. He's not old at all, but it can also presage things like injuries, because it goes to heck a little bit if you have lower body injuries and you're not remaining as stable. Your balance isn't as good, and you move your arm instead of your body to catch the ball. So it's worth keeping an eye on. I mean, Contreras looks fine. He hit a zillion home runs today, and he's been good. But the framing's been bad, and so it's worth keeping an eye on if it continues to be bad and if they react in any way to it.
So I think that the Will Smith thing here is our hint that it is too early to really get too concerned about this.
It absolutely is.
Yeah, because Will Smith is a pretty good framer in his own right. And the fact that he's down there with Will Smith, I think we definitely just have to let this one play out for the most part. There's reason to be a little concerned. It's something we have to put this on our watch list of things that we are keeping an eye on. But it's too early to get real concerned about it.
Yep. I think it's also worth noting that while framing is intended as a catcher-specific trait, that the pitch mix that is heading towards the catcher does matter. And this is a drastically different starting pitching staff than last year. It probably takes some time to adjust to that. And with a guy, for instance, like DL Hall, who is not in control of his pitches and around the edges all the time, you don't necessarily know where to set up to bring it back into the zone right away. That's going to take a little work. It's very easy to do that with Burns and Woodruff, who are going to put pinpoint control right on the edge every time, and you can set up for it. It's a lot harder with worse pitchers who are trying to dot the corner, but it's, you know, 3 inches further, and you got to put your glove out there to prevent a pass ball. So, nothing's independent completely, and while framing is, you know, looking at that as best it can, catchers are not robots, and they have to adjust to new players like anybody else does.
All right, so moving on, we talked about Bryce Terang's hot start earlier. Michael Parr has a question asking, is Bryce Terang the second coming of Rod Carew? More accurately, how sustainable is even average offense for Terang? Some small sample size, but his at-bats look at least competitive, and if he keeps that up, that's one position solved long-term for the Brewers. So, Ryan, I know there was some talk about him tweaking things. He's got, like, that huge, like, axe handle counterweight at the end of his bat. I don't know if that's doing anything. Have you seen anything, Ryan, that's like distinctively different this year that might provide some optimism that this sticks around?
No, I'm looking at Statcast numbers right now, and yeah, the exit velocity is up from 85.5 to 88.3, which has got him out of that blue zone for right now, but that's still not very good. Max EV is down, but it's too early to draw any real conclusions from that, obviously. Yep. But last year, his hard hit percent was 27%. This year, it's 11.8. So, yeah. Unfortunately, no, I actually was going back and forth with somebody on Twitter about this, and it was like, well, you won't find anybody who's spent more time hoping that Bryce Terang could be a league average sort of hitter slash position player for the Brewers than me. I've spent the last 5 years really, you know, banging that drum. And what I'm seeing so far, I don't feel any better than I did before the season started. He's hot at the moment, but I don't see any particular reason to think that it's some massive shift here. It's possible he gets better, but I don't think we're seeing it yet.
Yeah, if he'd popped a couple home runs at this point, or even some like crushing doubles, you know, we're seeing harder content. His launch angle's up from last year. Again, all small sample sizes. That's the theme of the podcast for the next month.
take a drink. Yep.
Yes, yeah. Take a drink. But Astrovia. Like, if you were looking at this profile and you were trying to guess what this looked like, and like his strikeouts are up, his launch angle's up, and his exit velocity is up, you might say, oh, maybe he's like stepped into a couple and knocked a ball or two out of the yard, and you know, you can work with, if you can get like 15 home run power out of him with the speed and the rest of it, that might work. But no, that's not the case. He has two hustle doubles, no home runs, and he's just hitting the ball into the air more and getting some, you know, bloopers to fall in and BABIP stuff and striking out, you know, more for not really any benefit. So I'm with Ryan. I think this is the most likely hot start to be completely illusory. It's nice that they're getting it. It's nice that when he is on base, he is swiping every time. It's very fun. But at some point, it's very likely this dries up as they run into better defensive teams and better pitching.
Yeah, and his defense has been absolutely unbelievable. Two more great plays today from
today
what it sounded like on the radio.
Just amazing, yeah.
Yeah,
nothing wrong with the defense at second base. It's valuable and it's a good floor. But
yeah, he's a great defensive replacement guy to have off the bench. I think that in and of itself, while he's, you know, making the league minimum, you are perfectly happy to have that. But at this point, I wouldn't want to be relying on him to be your everyday or even really the heavy side of a platoon second baseman. That's not an ideal place to be in at this point, I don't think. Mm-hmm.
Well, they are heading to Cincinnati, so maybe this is his chance to hit a couple home run, fluky home runs out and really bump up that slugging percentage. We'll see. Bob Peterson talking about another infielder. Is it reasonable to remain optimistic about Oliver Dunn becoming our primary third baseman this year? How is his defense? Another guy hot with the bat. I liked seeing him at the top of the lineup on Sunday. I think he could be a nice little leadoff option, you know, given his eye at the plate. But Ryan, what do you think about Ollie Dunn so far?
Well, now here's the opposite side of the coin from from Bryce Turan.
Oh, yeah.
His average exit velocity is 94th percentile. It's actually 94.5 is what his average
He's
exit velocity
it.
Is.
Yeah.
Yep, he is stinging it. And his hard hit percentage is 93rd percentile. And his hard hit percentage is... So he is actually hitting the ball hard, and so I feel much better about his offense. Paul, go ahead.
Yes. No, I mean, I would urge anybody who is curious about this, like the hot starts of the guys that you maybe aren't trusting that well, to go to Baseball Savant and look at Bryce Turang versus Oliver Dunn. And you don't even need to know the stats or on anything about them. Just look at the red versus the blue on both. And Oliver Dunn's profile looks great. And of course, it's early and you can get lucky in your production both ways. But he has stung the ball. And he's been legitimately good at doing that. And so like his looks like it's much more likely to stick. This is not illusory. This is hard hit balls. Honestly, Oliver Dunn should probably have a little bit more offensive production than he does, if anything, based on the underlying way that he's striking the ball. So, yeah, and he might come crashing back to earth when people adjust to him because people are getting used to him. But so far, that offense is real. He is stinging it.
Yeah. Now, the fielding part of this, I have to give a caveat here because his OAA, his fielding range, 87th percentile, really, really good on StatCast. But that's really early. We're talking about very small samples here. I don't want to read anything into that. On the fielding side, I have concerns because I haven't liked his hands. In spring training, it was something I noticed that his hands didn't seem to be good. He just doesn't seem to have a good feel for that. And so watching him field, I think he probably has decent range defensively to be able to get two baseballs. But actually completing, he had a play yesterday that looked pretty bad where the ball squirted away from him. And yeah, so that part of things, I'm more concerned about the defensive side of things for him than I am anything else. But given that you have Bryce Turang already holding down second base and you have somebody like Joey Ortiz as a potential defensive replacement, if Dunn is good offensively on the strong side of the platoon, you can offset a lot of this with, you know, Ortiz playing against the righties, or sorry, against the left-handed pitching, and also being a defensive replacement. I think you can make this work really, really well. So much more reserved, because he was asking about the defense, more reserved about the defense, but there might be something here. There might be something here.
And I do think his range is pretty good. One of the big problems yesterday was he was actually getting to balls and botching them that Willie was going to get. You know, he was actually stretching pretty far, and that's what he's supposed to do. Third baseman's supposed to take the ball if he can get to the ball. But, you know, he does have to actually start making those plays. But, you know, you can even, I think, work on that. Like, range is you can't teach range. You can teach the rest of it over time. So he might even get better at that, and he's not hopeless. I'd always rather have a guy who can get to the ball than not get to the ball. So they might have something here. That Oliver Dunn, first of all, I should have bothered to do more research on him beforehand. Spent all my time on Jake Bowers, dang it. He has been legitimately good so far.
Yeah, and yeah, they went and picked him up from the Phillies in the offseason because they saw something, and I think this was a targeted acquisition that they went after him to do this. And so he's only 26 years old. He had a breakout as a 25-year-old. Guys like this sometimes have. I was telling a friend when he was asking about it when I was driving the other day. Guys like this sometimes have runs for a little while in the big leagues. Like, the extreme example is somebody like Dan Uggla, where he ends up actually having, like, he comes up late and sort of ends up producing. Yeah. That's an extreme example of this. But there are guys who just kind of figure it out a little bit later than others. And I think we may be looking at that with Oliver Dunn. We have to reserve judgment, but I think it's certainly in the realm of possibility.
Yeah, I think so far he's actually kind of been, I think, maybe what we imagined Tyler Black to be in the majors, right? Like, offensively and question marks defensively, right? But he's kind of filling that role almost exactly, which is kind of wild to think about. All right, Jeffy G, next question, asking, historically, it seems that Wisconsin sports teams have embraced Midwest nice in the sense of staying in line and sanding down any rough edges. It feels almost weirdly refreshing to have a guy like Reese Hoskins on the team. Do you think there's some definite upside to having a lightning rod type of player on the roster to spark the occasional fire? The last decade has felt pretty vanilla since the Carlos Gomez days. Paul, you're kind of nodding along here. What do you think?
There definitely is, and we should also mention Nigel Morgan along with Carlos Gomez.
Yeah.
Yes.
Ryan Braun. Yeah.
Yes. And also, and Ryan Braun. Same kind of thing. There, if nobody's read The Art of Fielding, first of all, it's a great book. It's by Wisconsin author Chad Harbach. And in the penultimate, I won't spoil it, but in the penultimate game of that game, there is a jerk on the team and just decides to plunk a guy for no reason, which comes in handy later when, because everybody gets warned. And as you know, when the teams are warned that you shouldn't be throwing at people, then the next person that hits somebody, the pitcher's ejected, and they end up having a batter step into a pitch to get a pitcher ejected. You know, there's a place for inspiration of dirty players and a place for strategy of dirty players. And if you get into the other team's head, it can actually pay dividends. Nice doesn't always work. And having somebody with some edge when people are being a little lackadaisical or not into the game or giving up on a game that's like, you know, four runs down is nice to have. Reese Hoskins is fun. He's making people angry. And I feel like we're more often the victims of this kind of thing than the perpetrators of it. But it's nice to be able to do all of the aspects of psychological warfare in sports. And you need one or two of those guys to be able to do it effectively.
It's the cardinal way.
Yeah,
it is the cardinal way. It is 100% the cardinal way.
I will echo all that. And I also do want to point out, because I saw this today and it was great, Nationals announcers taking a not so subtle shot at Jeff McNeil. If you want to see this, check out my timeline. And Jeff McNeil and the New York Mets. So the Nationals announcers know about Jeff McNeil and his act and got on him a little bit for it in today's game. So that is worth seeking out if you have not caught that. That was pretty amusing.
Moving on, Brad Westness asking, when did the Brewers start playing Hall and Oates and Bob Marley after wins and losses? Is that an Adonasio era thing, or does it date back to Selig's tenure? What songs would you pick to play after a Brewers win and loss? I feel like you know, the Hall & Oates has been around for a while, you know, but I don't know Bob Barley for the losses might be.
No,
new,
it is. No. It's the don't worry about a thing.
I got it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the Three Little Birds. So as far back as I can remember, I've had season tickets since 2006. I don't know when I first started noticing it, but it's been as long as I have any memory that Bob Marley song plays after losses. So
okay. And I feel like I've heard Hall & Oates after every win I've attended to Paul's agreeing. So I guess what songs, Paul, would you pick for a win and a loss?
Oh, I had loss prepared. And I would actually, one of my like four walk-up songs when I have to be on a podcast and they ask me if I want, is Bandidos by The Refreshments. And that's actually what I would play after a loss. I think it's appropriate enough. It is vengeful, calls people stupid. So that's my lost one. The celebration song, I think, is harder because there's a lot of niche things you could do, but you actually want to have something pretty all-encompassing and probably somewhat cheesy. I have a problem actually picking that out. That's not really my jam. So I'm not really sure on the win. I would just defer to the lamest music producer that I could find to give an opinion on that. Like Oh What a Night in with Frankie Valli is totally fine. I don't care that much.
Yeah, I honestly, the lost one, that just is fine. I don't feel any need to change that up whatsoever. The
Bob Marley one's perfect, honestly.
Yeah, it's perfect. Yeah, it's just it hits the vibe exactly because it's baseball, and very, very rarely are you leaving after a loss and it's actually like really a devastating like thing. It's like after a playoff loss, after very late season when you have to win games. But for most of
really quick for loss, I changed my answer to The End by The Doors because I actually think it would be hilarious in context. So I'm on board with that now.
Yeah, I don't know about
it's also 15 minutes long, so it'll get everybody out of the stadium.
No, the Hall & Oates, it's fine. I was thinking maybe like the Brewers keep turning up the heat, but then we become the Cubs with that stupid ass song. And like,
yeah, I don't want to do that.
I don't want to do that at all. Like, no.
I feel like songs about winning are all bad and cheesy. I was just going through them in my head. Like, you could do like Eye of the Tiger, Winner Takes It All. Like, there's not a good song about winning. They're all bad.
Yeah, there's the one that I remember specifically. I don't know why I was thinking of this, but during the stretch run in 2018 when the Brewers were catching up to the Cubs, I started playing after every win. Ryan Bingham, the song Guess Who's Knocking, which is just like straight badass rock and roll. And it also includes a drop of it's Guess Who's Knocking on the Door, Guess Who's Knocking on the Door. It's me, MF-er, I'm knocking on the door. And then it just like shreds. And that was a lot of fun because it was, you felt that coming, like, we are coming for you. We are coming to take you. So contextually, something like that, but it only works with certain wins in certain time periods. So,
that's definitely no New York, New York by Sinatra like the Yankees do. That's very intense.
Good. Nauseating.
No, I think when the Yankees lose, they do That's Life, which is a nice, like, so what? See you tomorrow one. Yep. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right, Price Trozen, last couple of questions here. Price's question, what can be done about the trend of shredded elbows? Is it really that much more prevalent versus previous years? Still, I don't envy Scott Behringer and his staff. So this, of course, coming off of Spencer Strider probably needing Tommy John, Shane Bieber officially needing Tommy John. Paul, I know, you know, the players union had a statement out like blaming the pitch clock. How much of hurrying between pitches is a thing here, or how much of it is just max effort all the time being a factor?
So I think it's both. And I do think the pitch clock probably has some impact. So I don't think we should discount that entirely because there's been a few little research papers on this since the clock came into being. And it does seem like, well, first of all, it's not uniform that it causes more injuries, but what it does seem to do is cause more of certain types of injuries and have either no impact or less of certain other types of injuries. But I haven't seen anything recent on elbow, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's true. But max effort all the time is certainly part of that. Guys are going shorter distances in games and throwing harder, and that's not good for you. So part of me actually does not have that much sympathy for pitchers who get hurt here. I mean, I don't want anybody to blow out their elbow. That sucks, and it could ruin your career. But part of playing the game is actually being able to manage your own workload and how hard you throw to get guys out. Not to be old man about this, but pitchers in the 80s and 90s would save their hardest pitches in reserve for the toughest parts of the lineup and throw less hard to worse parts of the lineup. And that is how you pitched properly. And that's why old man pitchers say things like he's just a thrower, not a pitcher, and whine about guys not making it as far. Now, all of that said, there may be a way to maybe increase the clock by 5 seconds and cut down on X percent of injuries, and something like that would be worth doing. You could also, of course, give back commercial time and shorten the game that way, but no owners are going to do that. But having a fast game probably means pitchers need to adjust how they pitch more than anything else. And it's a tough incentive problem because you get paid to strike guys out. You get paid to throw hard. And so it's kind of a big mess. Don't have a good thing for it. But honestly, one of the reasons we have, as we've mentioned many times on this podcast, one of the reasons we have more pitcher injuries is because modern medical science has allowed a bunch of guys who would have gotten hurt in the past to pitch in the big leagues by keeping them healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that has happened with speeding up the game and going max effort is it is re-exposing all those same guys to factors that hurt them. And that is maybe not fair. Life isn't fair. But you know, some guys aren't perhaps built to hold up to what you need to do to pitch in Major League Baseball long-term. And that might be an unsatisfying answer, but it might be a true one.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. So I'm going to disagree with you on some of this. But so part of the thing here is, the biggest thing is, the incentives are all aligned from the time you're a little kid, from the time you are like good enough for scouts to start noticing you, like say when you're 14 or 15 years old, your incentives are to throw the ball as hard as you can to get noticed, to get scouts to start watching you, to start getting attention for college scholarships, to get potentially drafted, all those things. And so there's, the incentives here are all for those kids to throw as hard as they possibly can, as often as they possibly can. And if they can't, then that immediately starts to weed them out of the process and makes them potentially like non-prospects. So I think that like when you're talking about incentives, that's absolutely like this is a classic setup of there being cross incentives here, where for any one pitcher, it is in their best interest to be throwing their hardest at any given time. But for their team, you know, the really, really, really good ones, it's probably in their best interest to not do that and to start learning how to do things. And I think, you know, that goes back to Sandy Koufax. I always love telling the story. Sandy Koufax was asked about this once, where he was like, you know, back in my day, we did this thing where we weren't throwing as hard as we possibly could, and we would save it for specific moments in the game. And somebody said, well, should pitchers do that now? And he said, well, you can't now, because everybody can hit home runs. Back in my day, there might be two or three guys in a lineup where you really had to worry about getting taken out of the park. And other than that, you really only had to bear down when there were runners on base. But now, with everybody being able to hit the ball out of the park at any moment, it's kind of like everybody's in running, or everybody's in scoring position all the time. So it's changed that stuff. Now, with the pitch clock specifically here, I don't know. I'm pretty skeptical. I retweeted somebody who pointed out, you know, the platonic ideal of fast pitchers, Mark Burley. That dude didn't have like a missed start in his lifetime, and that guy threw
Ben Sheets.
Okay, so Ben Sheets would be the counterexample to that, but like, I don't know how much that part of it is actually mattering. The research that MLB put out in response to the Players Union was that the research that they've looked at has found really not anything here. I think it's probably too early to say for sure, because we're only looking at a year. This is the first year after the year when they rolled this out for the first time. So we're going to have to wait to really get a better idea. I think this is one of those things that's just kind of a problem in general. And honestly, there's a thing that cuts against all of that for MLB. The idea, if MLB got to the point where basically nobody viewed any pitchers as reliable in any way, shape, or form, that starts to turn it into a situation where I think pitchers aren't going to be getting the kind of big contracts that everybody expects them to get. I mean, what we saw this year with, say, Snell. If we're headed in that direction where teams are just like, you know what, we're not going to give big contracts to pitchers because they're just going to get hurt and we're not going to do this thing, I don't think that's actually an outcome that MLB wouldn't want. So that gets into some, there could be some really weirdly mixed incentives here where MLB might not hate this as much as you think they might. And that starts to get really tricky because in some perspectives, it's, you know, better for teams to just get pitchers to give them everything they have as long as, you know, they're in those early first 6 years when they're not expensive anyway. Go and give us everything you have during that time period. And then we're happy to just have you not be around after that because then we don't have to pay you. So
pitchers are just running backs, basically, is what I'm hearing.
Yep.
There is some of that to this where it's just like they're already being viewed as more disposable. And I think, you know, obviously there's always going to be exceptions. There's going to be guys who have longer careers, but I think we're already looking at some of that. So yeah, it's what we will see.
All right. Last question on a Patreon this week before we get out of here. Patrick Detmer asking non-Brewers question. Hanlon's razor states never attribute to malice that which can be adequately explained by stupidity. It's one of my favorite sayings. When it comes to John Fisher and how he has treated the city of Oakland, however, shouldn't we attribute it to both malice and stupidity?
And other stuff, too, I'm sure.
Yeah. All right. So any thoughts about the soon to be Sacramento Nomad A's?
I would also add pride in there a little bit. Arrogance, if you want. I think the owner's club is definitely motivated by having people that aren't them pay for Stadia. However, I do think part of it is non-monetary and that it's sort of a mark of shame to not pull that off. And so, you know, John Fisher is... stupidity is in not in failing to bilk people properly, and part of that is by not being two-faced enough, by not playing both sides of the coin and being in Oakland's good graces. You know, the A's really have this is the sowing here. The reaping is, you know, you don't spend on the team, you don't do any upgrades on the experience. You you're the paltry, stupid Moneyball team for 20 years that, you know, the Oakland people, they embrace that a little bit as being underdogs who are competing on string, blah, 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 blah. But it also makes everybody hate you when you don't spend money on the team or upgrade the experience. And then when you go to ask them for stuff, they're going to say, you haven't done jack, so no. So Fisher, stupid for not playing the owner's game properly, for losing this, and also poor planning on logistics of where your team's going to play. This is bad all around. So yes, the answer to your question is yes. This is both several other things in addition to stupidity and malice.
John Fisher is a perfect example of inherited wealth being stupid.
Yep.
Like this is what it is. Like, you put his picture up there because this guy is just, he's a failson, and he should not be in this position to be able to do this, and he is, and it's disgusting and just awful. And you look around at, like, the worst run teams in baseball over time, and by and large, they are by these people who inherited their wealth and did not actually make it themselves. And, yeah, it comes as zero surprise that this would be happening. But he really does seem to have – arrogance was a wonderful way to put this, because more than anything, he thinks he's the master of the universe and can just dictate to people whatever he wants. And you can see it in how he's like ordering around his social media team to just like act like they're the Russian photograph people from the, was it the Stalin era, where they're just like airbrushing out people whenever they get sent to the gulags and they get erased from history. There's just all these people being airbrushed out of photo. Like, they are just, they think that they can control every bit of public scrutiny. It's a good lesson for other teams, not looking at anybody in particular, Milwaukee, that you can't go down this path too far before it really starts to hurt, before it really starts to do bad things to your perception. You have to be careful about not engaging in this kind of crap, because when you get to this sort of ridiculous, this is like the most ridiculous extent of it, but when you get down there, it really does, it sucks, and it's terrible for the people of Oakland. And the Sacramento thing is just going to be, I think, comical, but like sadly comical. It's just going to be really kind of pathetic.
All right. Thank you for the questions, everybody, this week. Again, patreon.com/mketailgate is where you can sign up to become a patron. $2 a month gets question priority. Make sure your questions get answered. That'll do it. Obviously, a good week for the Brewers. Hopefully things continue. First, big long road trip of the season coming up. They'll be in Cincinnati for, I think, 4 games, and then a weekend series, which should be a very interesting weekend series in Baltimore against Corbin Burns' Orioles. Sounds like he may pitch right before the Brewers get to town, so maybe we avoid that matchup this go around. We'll see what happens there. But I won't be here next week. Ryan and Paul will be. They'll have somebody stepping in for me, so you can tune in then and make sure you get everything recapped all nice. Hopefully a good series in Cincinnati as those division games start up as well. In the meantime, have a good one, everybody. We'll see you here next time on Milwaukee's Tailgate. There, where the band is not what I am, even though the zip code has changed. I buy a smile and joy where I'm currently employed. Your soul can't be rearranged. Fair weather, fair weather.